Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Now in depth on the path to belonging. Harun Mogul's parents had his life all neatly planned. He'd go to medical school, he'd complete his residency, he'd begin his life as a doctor, and only then find some nice Muslim girl to marry at 35. Didn't quite work out that way. There would be no med school. Girls were elusive at times. He struggled with being bipolar, and his commitment to his faith waxed and waned. I might enjoy a burst of piety, he writes, a fit of seriousness and fidelity, praying on time and regularly, but these spells would rarely last more than a few days. Mr. Mogul's long and winding road to faith and happiness makes for a delightful memoir. And as he joins us, you know, I thought it might be interesting to hear about your path to your faith. Did it take you years of seeking to find the faith in which you now belong? What did you learn about yourself along the way? And I'll assume that some of us are still seeking, so I'd like to hear about that as well. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. And on Twitter, where I'm hearing from some of you about this, it's at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. Harun Mogul's memoir is titled How to Be a Muslim, an American Story, and he's with us today from New York City. And Harun, welcome. I'm so glad to get a chance to talk to you about your memoir. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you.
The word belonging, I think, is something to consider here, because I wonder if that sense of not belonging gets stamped somehow into the essence of who you are, even after you've resolved a lot of that stuff you went through in adolescence, that this is something that becomes a part of you that's hard to leave behind.
Absolutely. I think for a lot of my life, I felt like I was on the outside looking in. Definitely when I was in school, in high school. But even since then, I think that's kind of the default mode. So when I'm not really paying attention to myself, or maybe I'm feeling a little bit down on myself, I tend to see myself as being someone who doesn't really belong and who's merely participating in conversations from a distance away, and not being at the heart of things, at the center of things, which I'm sure being a minority also feeds into. You tend to see yourself on the outside, or people see you on the outside, and so you're convinced that they're right. But you also learn over time that maybe there's some insight and wisdom in that that you can't get otherwise.
I was going to say, you know, some of the most perceptive writers live with that all the time, grew up with that and experienced that, and that's what makes them great observers. Do you think there's something to that?
Absolutely. I would actually make that point and go farther to say, in this political moment, one of the values of a society that welcomes immigrants is that we welcome people who see us from a different perspective than ourselves and help us see our strengths and weaknesses, maybe in ways we wouldn't otherwise be able to pick up on. Outsiders sometimes understand things better than insiders ever could.
What do you think belonging means to you?
That's a great question. I think it's the ability to sit with yourself and be alone with yourself. I think ultimately a lot of the technology that we use and a lot of the gadgets and gizmos that we're surrounded by, they obviously have value and they have purpose. I'm talking to you remotely, so I can't be hypocritical about that. But I do think that sometimes we distract ourselves from ourselves. And to me, belonging is this feeling that you are okay with yourself. Because if you're not okay with yourself, you don't really participate in anything out of any genuine sense of conviction. You're just latching onto things because you're afraid of being alone with yourself.
You know, I think about this. You're in New York City, and when I visit New York City and I see the way people now walk the sidewalks or, you know, act in a busy place, they are they're focused inward. Much of that, and maybe these were uncomfortable moments for a lot of people, that interaction that we once had to have, because that's where your attention was focused, is now focused inward. And you can, even if you're texting the one friend that you have that helps you, you know, make you feel like you belong, you're able to do that in a way that you couldn't, I don't know, 15 years ago. You had to live with your sense of alienation more so, I think. What do you think of that?
So I was in Amsterdam about 2 weeks ago for a conference, actually, between Christian and Muslim leaders. And so Amsterdam's a beautiful city, and if you're going to fly me somewhere for free, I'm always down. But, you know, it occurred to me when I was in Amsterdam that this is Dutch culture is the culture that produced New York City in many ways.
Right.
So there were these overlaps in terms of the cosmopolitanism and the openness to difference and the mercantile nature of the city. But one thing that occurred to me when I was there is that, you know, when I had time free during the conference, I would just hop on a train and I went to The Hague, I went to Harlem, I went to different cities in the Netherlands. But I could do that because I had a phone. And it almost required very little effort of me. I mean, I was never actually lost because as long as I could get signal, I would figure out where I was and orient myself very easily. And so I think that we've even forgotten what it was like to be detached. And I wonder if that inability to detach might ultimately be some kind of harm to us. I will also add that in New York City, it's always amazing to me that people cross the street while texting. I mean, like, no matter how urgent the conversation, one would think that it's like the great Darwinian equalizer here, right? Like, it's like there are large vehicles traveling back and forth, and you're just texting, and apparently don't really care if you get run over. Maybe the conversation's that important. I don't know.
I love what you say about being lost, because the last time I traveled, I realized that I felt really uncomfortable with something that I used to love to do, which is, and I'm a terrible map reader anyway, so throw the map away and wander. And I don't know that I have that capacity anymore, because I am really accustomed to being able to say, hey, the phone will tell me right where I am. I don't know if I can do that anymore, if I can truly be lost.
I don't know how people made plans before. I know we did, but like, what happens if you're late, or what happens if you can't find the restaurant, or what happens? I mean, I guess people just kind of went with it and rolled with it and just kept going. But to me now, it's just this frenetic need to know what's happening at every second of every day.
Let me grab a call here from John in Minneapolis. Hi, John. Sounds like you've heard something that resonates with you.
Yes, I think it's very, very difficult for people who, you know, follow a very orthodox faith like Islam. I'm an Orthodox Christian. So I think it's very difficult to incorporate, you know, an almost, I don't want to say feudal, but it comes from a different age, a different background entirely, and to incorporate all of that. But in the end, it's very worthwhile, and I'm just very persistent, and I'm 61, and I think finally I've sort of been able to do that. And I think you're much richer for it, and I think you have things to offer to this society, you know, present contemporary American society and people with very different values as something very beautiful and worthwhile.
Haroon, what do you think of that?
I think John's right. So in the Muslim tradition, we believe that God communicates to humanity and through the form of the Quran, and the Prophet Muhammad embodies the Quran. So if you want to read what God says, you read the Quran, and if you want to know how to live it, you look at Muhammad and the Quran together. And what John's point is exactly correct, that how do you then translate someone who lived in 7th century Arabia in a completely different social context and political environment into 21st century New York City? And that is the struggle, I think, at the heart of what it means to be a Muslim or to try to be a Muslim. And that's where I am right now, which is trying to figure out what the balance between those two things is. Because if you go too far in either direction, I do think you lose something in the process, whether it's a loss of spirituality or a loss of relevance and connectedness to the world around you.
But
that tension.
I was just going to say, Haroon, that's really interesting, because most tenets of religions come from an ancient time that requires a lot of interpretation. What is it, do you think, about Islam that might be different in that way?
Well, I think some of it has to do with the way in which Islam emerged as a religion. And this is not to say one religion's better than another, but religions do have significant differences between them. So the Muslim tradition was very quickly codified after the death of the Prophet Muhammad because of the political circumstances into which it emerged. The Christian tradition took a lot longer to kind of come together, in part because Christianity was born on the margins of empire and Muslims inherited an empire. So they devoted a lot of resources immediately into this. So the life of the Prophet Muhammad is more closely historically documented than the life, for example, of Jesus. And so what you have is you have a lot of source text. And so how to then apply that becomes even more challenging because you have more material to work with. You have less flexibility, in a sense, when you have something pinned down in greater detail. That said, of course, I think every religion has the same tensions and the same challenges. What made my story different, and probably that of a lot of Muslims in the United States, is that many of us are very recent immigrants or of recent immigrant origin. So we're balancing religious culture, what it's like to be an immigrant or to be the child of immigrants, American culture, and then, of course, the fact that right now being Muslim in the United States is a particularly fraught proposition, which adds another layer to that very personal, very individual struggle.
I've been really eager to ask you about something that you write in the memoir about religion and culture. You say, I was taught that religion and culture were two different and exclusive things, that the more of one you had, the less of the other. This is not only very stupid, but it explains why so much of religious Muslim life is so god-awful boring. Well, you must expand on that. What? Tell me more.
You want me to expand on boring? That's a tough one.
I want you to expand on this idea of why Muslims are taught to believe that religion and culture have to be separate.
So there's been a trend in Islam in the past century. I don't know if I can name it just because I don't know what to call it, but I think it's been particularly damaging and toxic, which basically teaches that anything that does not accord directly and immediately with the circumstances of 7th century Arabia needs to be discarded or has to be viewed as problematic at best. And so what you get is, instead of a religion that informs and enriches your life wherever it is, you get a religion that asks you to go to war with the culture you live in and the time and place you come from. And that tendency, this flattening, it's almost like the McDonald's effect in religion. Like, you create this universal fast food type religion that is the same no matter where you go in the world, is deeply damaging because people are individuals. They're not simply Big Macs or what have you. And so that's what I was responding to, is that you get something that is in some ways very easy because it's the same thing no matter where you go, but it's very boring. It's bad for you. And it causes you to miss out on all this incredible, complex, rich, and nuanced life that's going on around you all the time.
But can you think of a specific example?
Sure. So, you know, I'll give you an example. In Persian, the word for God is Khuda, K-H-U-D-A. It's just a Persian word. And in a lot of the Muslim world, including Pakistan, where my family is from, the Persian word for God is the word that people used on a day-to-day basis. And there is a tendency now in Pakistan to say that you shouldn't use that word. You should use the Arabic word for God. It's as if someone were to come to the United States as a Muslim and say, well, you shouldn't use the word God because that's not what the Prophet Muhammad called God. It seems like an incredibly trite and banal point, but it's like you're basically going to war with the very language you speak.
Mm-hmm.
And you get this very interesting tendency that, you know, if the Prophet Muhammad dressed a certain way, you have to dress in exactly that way. Ignoring the fact that, for example, the clothing options available to someone in 7th century in a desert are particularly different from what someone should be wearing in New York City in January.
Wow.
And yet you get people who do believe that that's what you're supposed to do. And it goes from it causes you to jump from trying to look at someone's life and find inspiration and direction in it to literally, like, basically foregoing your own reason and giving up on your own intellect and just saying, well, whatever happened then, I'm just going to do it because that's easier.
You know,
and as a result, you get a religious life that's really flat.
It doesn't sound all that different from the debates that go on within Christian circles about whether to take the Bible literally. I mean, think of the books, Haroon, that have been written about how to interpret the Bible, how to understand the context in which it was written, what it really means when you bring a modern or contemporary sensibility to it. Do you think it's all that different?
No, I don't think it's that different. And actually, that's one of my hopes for the book, is that obviously there are peculiarities to being Muslim in the United States right now. No other religious group right now is really being discussed as a candidate for being banned for entry as immigrants or what have you.
Yeah.
But I mean, at the same time, I mean, Islam comes out of the same tradition as Judaism and Christianity. Religions often, you know, religions all speak to people. People are not that different from each other. And ultimately, what I wanted to do with the book was to explain to people that maybe the language in which I'm speaking spiritually is different, but the grammar underneath it is not. This is ultimately a human story.
Oh, that's so well said. Haroon Mogul is with us this morning. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about his memoir. It has a lot of humor in it. Yes, we've started out talking about faith here, which is a thread, of course, that runs through the memoir, How to Be a Muslim and American Story. But there's a lot of stories and anecdotes from his childhood, his parents' expectations, what it meant to be an immigrant family in America, with all of the fraughtness, to use his word, that comes with that. And I'm curious about, as you join into this conversation, whether it's taken you years of seeking to find the faith in which you now belong. Does some of what we're talking about reconciling the principles of that faith and modern living resonate with you? What did you learn about yourself along the way? 651-227-6000. On Twitter, Amber says, I converted to Islam in 2012 at the age of 32. I learned how to let go of my need to control everything and also learned how little I can control. Richard says, yes, faith is trust. It takes time or a significant emotional event to develop trust in anything or anyone, and even God. Amy says, it seems to me that most faith practices require adherence to go on a journey. It's certainly been the case for me. This is how one grows. By the way, that's Amy Dickinson of Ask Amy tweeting in there. And to Kenneth in Minneapolis. Hi, Kenneth. Thanks so much for waiting.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call, first
sure.
off.
Of course.
I just wanted to touch on, I'm actually a non-believer, and I think faith as a whole is more dangerous to humanity than a good. I understand that a lot of people put most of their trust into something they call faith,
mm-hmm.
but faith is really just a belief in something without good evidence,
mm-hmm.
and doing that seems only more dangerous, and it seems strange to me that religion is basically the only thing that's given that pass to have faith, and that when you have that, you have all these interpretations of different faiths. So like in Christianity, here in America, we have how many sects of Christianity? You know? So everybody has their own opinion. We build these modern ideas of religion, and that just every different religion just goes to show, like when somebody personally feels something about their faith that they don't agree with, they just create a different faith in which they believe and they can follow.
Kenneth, this is good because Haroon writes about doubt and his time exploring Catholicism. Haroon, what would you say?
I think Kenneth is right. We can look at American history, for example, and we have interpretations of Christianity that justified slavery, and then we had interpretations of Christianity that produced, for example, the civil rights movement. There would be no civil rights movement, at least not as we understand it, without Martin Luther King. And so there is this fact that, to me, religion is very much like the Force, because Star Wars explains everything, that there are good forms of religion, there are bad forms of religion. And ultimately, religion is not a hard science. So I think Kenneth is right that you will have multiple interpretations. It's no different than if we were to have another court above the Supreme Court. Right? That a court would then have its own interpretations of the law, transcending or overriding the Supreme Court's interpretation. And I think that that can be a very dangerous thing, but it's also a very positive thing because it reflects the diversity of human experience and the range of human intellectual endeavor, that all these very different people are applying their minds and their reason to text and trying to make sense of it. And that's the same that holds in any literary or cultural or political field. But I do take Kenneth's point, and certainly as a Muslim, I'm more than aware of how religion can be used to harm people and to hurt people and to project darkness and evil into the world.
How seriously do you think you really considered atheism?
Not very seriously. For me personally, I never found the idea that the universe emerged on its own to be convincing. So Kenneth mentioned evidence. I don't see any evidence for a non-theistic worldview. I've never found anything convincing or compelling about that personally. Obviously, everyone's read of the world around them is different. For me, atheism was my way of having fun because religion was like this incredibly heavy, burdensome, awkward thing that I was just kind of dropped onto me and forced to carry when I didn't want to carry it and I wasn't strong enough to carry it. And I just wanted to go have fun and get drunk and go on dates. And so I decided that if I just shoved religion out of the way, I could do that. So it was a very tactical atheism. You know, it wasn't necessarily a deeply convinced atheism. I had fun. So
it all worked out. Here's the thing I really love about the memoir, too. You tell us, you communicate how there's a lot of value in the doubt and the struggle, and why, you know, that's not necessarily the best path to faith, but it was your path. I mean, you're not saying, and then I saw the light and cast aside all of those doubts. I put this as, when I've been telling people about the memoir, this, you know, long and winding and painful road to some realization that you wanted this faith in your life. How would you put it?
One of the comments you just read a few minutes ago was from a listener named Richard.
Right.
And he said that he mentioned that, you know, faith requires trust. And he mentioned that an emotional event is necessary to create trust or to demonstrate the need for trust. And the minute he said that, I loved it because it spoke very deeply to my own experience of faith and anything else. My parents, and God bless them for the hard work they put in, they raised us with very high expectations. And I don't begrudge them that, because I would rather be pushed to do more than to be satisfied with less. But there is a huge burden in being asked to accomplish so much, especially from parents who cross the planet to build an entirely new life for themselves. And you're constantly measuring yourself against that. And when I was in my early 30s, my life fell apart. I was depressed. I was actually suicidal. I'd lost my job. I was losing my marriage. I was losing my health. Everything was falling to pieces. And it occurred to me that I had confused religion for material circumstances, and that my whole idea of Islam was a certain kind of professional and public life. And when those things fell through, I was just alone in the world, and it was me and God. And I didn't know what to make sense of that. And that's why I loved what Richard said, that ultimately, faith isn't about evidence per se, and I don't mean faith is requiring us to be stupid. I mean, faith is about a relationship we develop with something outside of ourselves, and whether or not that relationship transcends some of our greatest anxieties and fears. And for me, that was being a failure and being alone. And yet there I was, a failure and alone, and I had to know what to do with that.
To Ahmad in Eden Prairie. Hi, Ahmad. Welcome to the show.
Yes. Hi, Carrie. I'm a retired physician. I am a Muslim, and I'm from Iran, and I have a lot in common with Harun. Mm-hmm. But my comment is that there is something fundamentally wrong with religion, because if you want to be religious, you have to consider the rest of the world who doesn't believe in your religion wrong. And if you say all religions are good, all people are good, then you are not religious.
Harun, what do you think?
So that's definitely a danger of religion. So I think Ahmad is correct that religion does sometimes encourage you to see the world tribally. I have two responses to that. The first is that when religion emerged and where it emerged, it often created new forms of identity that transcended local boundaries. So it is true that Islam, in many Muslims' eyes, divides the world between those who are Muslim and who aren't. And yet, 1.5 billion people are brought together under this religious umbrella, whereas before some of the larger monotheistic religions, maybe there was far greater diversity in the world and far less resource to bring people together. I don't know. But my actual substantive answer to that is simple. I was raised to believe that the more you know about Islam, the more likely you are to go to hell, which sounds counterintuitive to people. Because I was raised to believe that you have more to answer for if you know more. So to quote, you know, Uncle Ben, with great power comes great responsibility. And so Uncle Ben here is my parents and I'm Spider-Man. I'm not really sure how that works out. But somehow, if you let me run with this terrible analogy, I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. It's a good thing that this is live, because you can watch like my entire facility with the English language just fall apart before everyone's eyes. But read my book. But I was raised to believe that if you know about Islam and you understand Islam, then you actually have to practice it because you have something to answer for. And if you don't know about Islam and you're not conversant in the tradition, then God is not going to ask you about those things. And so there are interpretations of religion that actually do the opposite, that they don't ask you to believe that the rest of the world is doomed. They ask you to believe that you yourself are your first and primary priority. And so instead of worrying about what happens to other people, worry about what happens to yourself. But I think Ahmed's point is true, and that's one of the dangers of a religious life and that we have to be constantly on guard for, is that we don't allow ourselves to become smug or self-righteous and to look down on other people who believe differently or who practice differently than we do.
You say that there's a question that many Muslims feel but they hesitate to ask. Do you remember what the question is?
If Islam is so great, why are Muslims doing so badly?
Yeah. Why do Muslims hesitate to ask that?
See, that proves that I wrote the book, in case anyone is concerned that is not the case.
And it proves that I read it, right, if anybody's concerned. So why is that a question that Muslims hesitate to ask?
I was reading a book a few days ago by Gideon Rahman, who I believe is a Financial Times correspondent. I could be wrong. It's a book called Easternization, about the rise of Asia and the decline of America. And in the foreword to the book, he notes that the Chinese economy passed the United States economy in size a few years ago. And I remember reading that and kind of wincing inside, because as an American, and it may be a little bit ashamed to say this, part of my worldview is this assumption that America is the best. And sometimes it's just a feeling, but other times it's supposed to be corroborated by fact. Well, we are the world's largest economy. We are the world's most dynamic economy. We are X, we are Y, we are Z. And to read that another country had surpassed the United States for the first time in now 140-some years was hard to hear. Because I think we invest our identities with a certain pride. And for a lot of Muslims in the world today, you want to be proud of your religion, but you see so much bad and negativity and violence and harm associated with religion that it makes you wonder, it makes you doubt that, is this way of life really the truth? Does it really possess value? And if it does, how do I reconcile what I think this religion is with what is happening in so much of the Muslim majority world? And that's painful. I remember in your earlier segment, you had Stephen Cook on, and you were talking about the Arab Spring. I remember a lot of Muslims around the world were so proud during the Arab Spring, because it suddenly filled them with hope and light and enthusiasm. And here were people like themselves standing up in the face of guns and tanks and calling down governments and asking for something better, and they wanted to be associated with that. And the whole thing collapsed into further violence and greater authoritarianism and worse oppression. And what do you do with that?
You know, I hear what you're saying on with the example that you used of the Chinese economy has overtaken the U.S. economy. But I think we're also in a moment where we'd better really look hard at this conception of American exceptionalism. It's good for if Americans are willing to take that in and understand what that really means, I think it's good for us to turn that over and think about the implications of that. We need that.
I don't disagree with you. And I think for Muslims in this moment, sometimes there's this tendency to say that whatever's happening in the name of Islam, it has nothing to do with Islam. And I understand why people say that. But we can't hide from the fact that a lot of these groups and movements claim themselves to be Islamic. They call themselves Islamic. I mean, it's the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, right?
Right.
It's right there in the name of the group.
Right.
They are citing Quran. They're not making up religious scripture. I do think they're perverting it and manipulating it, but they at least superficially seem to be motivated by religion, although if we look closer, we see that in many cases it's utilitarian, it's instrumental. But the fact of the matter is that they are latching on to religion, and that forces us, no matter where we are as Muslims, to confront that. And my hope is that in confronting that, we start to build communities and institutions and visions of religion that are strong enough not just to condemn the extremism, but to promote an alternative that is far more attractive to it and eventually overruns it.
Here's a call from Serenity in Bloomington. Hi, thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
So I wanted to bring up, I'm the daughter of two pastors who are very liberal, And I find myself rejecting the more contemporary styles of worship in favor of a more traditional style. And I just wanted to bring up that often the children of people who become more liberal are looking for some sort of tradition or some sort of ritual to latch onto in their worship styles.
What do you think, Harun?
So for me personally, I mean, I the last few years of my life have been looking for something that that speaks to me where I am, but that is anchored in the Muslim tradition. So it was an earlier call, I believe, from John, who mentioned he was Orthodox Christian.
Right.
I get that, and I get what Serenity is saying. I think we all want to be connected to something that feels ancient and wise, and that maybe has a wisdom that we can't necessarily unpack immediately. And maybe a lot of that is just a reaction to a world in which nothing is stable anymore, that things change or fluctuate every 5 minutes. We cross traffic texting people. The world doesn't make sense anymore. So we're looking for something that that gives us a sense of place and a sense of time.
Will you understand if I'm curious about how your love life is going these days?
So I was doing my second book reading, and it was on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. And this woman said, "Oh, I saw that you're wearing a wedding ring. How's your current marriage going?" And first, I was like, "Excuse me?" I was like, "I'm not signing your book." But then it was like, "Well, I did put everything out there."
You did.
So I guess now I have to kind of have to own up to it. It's funny how, even as I was writing this, it didn't occur to me that it would actually be published and people would read it. So as a socially anxious person, every book reading I go to, it kind of feels like I'm just taking off my clothes and letting people judge me. And then at the end, I sign their book and I come back to my hotel room thinking that was awkward and painful. I do think that sometimes when I am doing a reading and people are asking me questions, I find that the act of writing the memoir actually helped me see myself a lot better. And I know that sometimes when I read memoirs, it's because I want to get insight into my own life. But it was a good thing to write because it helped me begin to see things about myself that I'm still working on and still addressing. But at least I'm aware that they exist.
Well, there's so much we didn't talk about. I hope you'll come back sometime. This has really been great for me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Harun Mogul's book is called How to Be a Muslim, an American Story. Read about it on The Thread.